Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening. I'm Victoria Barrett, an associate editor with Forbes magazine. I welcome you to this meeting of InForum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for young people who share an interest and passion in civic issues. Tonight, I'm joined by two women, Manisha Thakur and Sharon Kadar. They've created what I would call a young girl's guide to not going broke. Very useful. It's called On My Own Two Feet, and it offers a bevy of practical, no-nonsense tips to financial stability. Manisha and Sharon have worked as financial analysts and portfolio managers for leading investment firms. They met at the Harvard Business School, where they both are graduates. So let's start with this question. Why target this book at women? Are young women worse than their young male counterparts at managing their finances?
It's an excellent question, Victoria, and I'm very proud to say that the answer is absolutely not. The book is targeted at women. Let me backtrack. Financial literacy is a subject that's important for everyone, but it's particularly important for women because statistically speaking, we're the ones left holding the bag at the end of the day. 80% of men die married. 80% of women die single. And unfortunately, the bag that we have left at the end of the day is smaller than the guys because we still earn about 77 cents on the dollar. And oftentimes, as women, we'll move in and out of the workforce to care for children or aging parents. And that's the reason it's extra important for women to learn to live their lives from a position of financial strength.
The message that you guys offer up in the book is really applicable to men or women. And it's that you should think of your salary as a pie. Mm-hmm. And there are different ways that you can slice the pie, but you guys offer up a very specific way, mm-hmm. which you can explain these slices have specific sizes. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about those slices, mm-hmm. what they are, and mm-hmm. how you allocate them.
Okay. So, Victoria, first of all, the whole premise of the book is that personal finance does not have to be difficult. And there's really only three things, and you're talking about the key piece, the first piece that you need to do to be financially successful. It's to save, invest, and protect yourself, financially speaking. Saving is the first piece. Now, what you need to do to actually save enough is to think of your money as a pie. So when you think about your annual income, think about that pie, and guess what? Uncle Sam gets that first chunk, and it's a big bite. On average, it's about 25%. So when you're thinking about your income, you can't think about it all. What you actually have to spend, take out 25%. And then there's three pieces left that we like to talk about. 45% of your money, and these are rough guidelines, should go to what we call foundation expenses. These are things like your home and your car, basic things that you need to live your life on a daily basis. What's the magic between that 45? Well, it leaves 30%. 15% of that should go to fun. We really believe you need to balance today and tomorrow. Managing your money is not about depriving yourself, so you need to have some money for fun. And then 15% is for saving. You need to save for a few reasons, and we'll probably get into that.
And do you guys both live by these slices?
We do, although it's very interesting. There's a yin-yang between the two of us. We both save 15% of our income, but we get there in different ways. I'm a finance geek. When I was 12, my dad taught me about the power of compounding, and I've been obsessed with money and investing ever since. And so I do a very detailed budget. I literally keep track of every dollar I spend, and I can tell you within about $5 how much I've spent every year since 1992 when I first started doing this. But I do this because it helps me feel comfortable and on top of my money. Sharon, by contrast, arrives at the exact same place in a different way. She simply makes sure she saves 15% off the bat, and then she knows after her taxes that she has the remaining two slices for foundation and fund allocated as she sees fit. And there's no better or worse, right or wrong. They're just different ways of arriving at the same place, which is making sure that you have got that safety cushion.
And that's the whole deal. The whole reason you break up your money is ultimately so you have enough money saved. You save for an emergency fund. You save for things like your down payment on a home. And you save for retirement. So when you guys think about breaking out your money, as long as you're saving 15%, you're in good shape. Personally, I hate budgeting, really. When we did it, I was drinking a beer at home. And afterwards, I went out and bought a fancy purse. So, you know, that's me. That's why we're yin-yang, but as long as you're saving 15%, you're in good shape.
And remind me, how much is left in my discretionary fund money? How much my salary?
15%, so it's half and half. You're balancing the desire. This is how we think about it. You're balancing the desire to enjoy today with the need to save and invest for tomorrow. And that 15% that we're suggesting you put towards tomorrow, and the 15% we suggest you put towards today and fun may seem like eye-popping numbers because most people aren't quite there to start out with. But the most important thing to know is that's your goal. That's where you're heading. And even if you just start saving a little bit today, just taking that first step and having the knowledge is incredibly powerful.
So that to me seems to fall under the category of easier said than done. Because a lot of young women and men, young people in general, have, you know, relatively low salaries. You're starting out in the workforce, and maybe you live in a really expensive city like San Francisco or New York. So 15% of your $40,000 doesn't leave you with much for going out to dinner, clothing yourself, the basics.
Victoria, so that's a fair point. So first of all, as Manisha said, knowledge is power. So if you can't get there today, if you set your mind to it, you will get there. We know people making $30,000 a year who get there. We know people who make $100,000 a year that don't. So it's really about a commitment. And there's ways to do it. One example is if your employer offers a retirement plan, committing a set amount to that retirement plan and getting used to your new take-home pay, which is a bit lower because you're putting money aside for retirement, is a great way to actually be disciplined about it.
And one other thing to keep in the back of your mind is money is sometimes this pink elephant in the room. We talk about all kinds of things in this country. You turn on daytime TV and whoo. But how much we really make and how much we really spend all too often is not one of those things that we really are open and frank about. So if you ever find yourself looking around at your neighbors and thinking, gosh, like, how can they live like that? Chances are they can't. You would be amazed how many Americans are living beyond their means.
Yeah, so when you look around, really, people do not have a clue about money. And even if they act like they do, they don't. So when you see a guy driving some fancy car, that probably is the biggest asset he has. And the data bears it out. 70% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck.
I guess the issue is, if let's say I'm 25 years old and I'm making $35,000 a year, I would just wonder, well, does it really matter if I'm saving? I mean, really, I'm 25 years old. Who knows how much I'm going to be making in 5 years? I'll make it up later.
I'm really glad you asked that. And let's talk about two girlfriends as an example. So Amy and Zandra are friends. They save the same amount. They save $5,000 a year for 10 years. Amy starts at age 21. Zandra starts at age 41. When they wake up at age 65 at retirement, they're leading very different lives. Because Amy started 20 years earlier, she'll have $2 million in her retirement nest egg. Zandra will have $300,000. Yeah. Amy will be having her martini smiling on the beach. Zandra might be cleaning the beach.
And that's really the power of having your money investing over a long period of time. And Manisha, as you mentioned earlier, the magic of compounding interest. But I think a lot of people don't quite follow what compounding interest is. Maybe it's worth explaining.
Sure. Compounding interest is just a fancy schmancy way of saying that you're earning money not only on what you originally invested, but on the fruits of your investments. And it's really magical. The easiest way to think about it is just a line. And when you start investing early, that line has a really steep slope. And I we can't emphasize enough that the money you save in your 20s and 30s is the most valuable money you will save in your entire life because it has so much more time to grow. And one of the things that we always like to say when people ask us, you know, so why start saving now? It literally is just like when you go to your dermatologist and you say, well, you know, I want to prevent wrinkles. When should I start using sunscreen? And she tells you, start now. Well, you may not see the benefits right away, but 20, 30 years down the road when everybody else is all tight and Botoxed up and you're still looking fresh and natural, you're happy. Same thing with saving.
Like flossing, right?
Exactly.
Okay. You mentioned earlier the guy driving that fancy car might not be worth all that. And that falls under, you know, Americans have fallen in love with loans. And what are the tricks of getting out of debt, especially when, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of folks are living paycheck to paycheck? How do you do it?
How do you get out of debt?
Yeah.
It's committing to getting out of the debt. So, for instance, if you're sitting with a pile of debt right now saying, well, how the heck can I save when I have this debt? There's a few simple steps that you can take to get that debt down. So, first of all, you have to pay all of your bills on time. That's important, just basic financial hygiene. It also protects your financial reputation, which comes in the form of a 3-digit number called your credit score. Next, you have to build up a $2,000 emergency fund. That's actually the average unexpected expenses for a woman in her mid-20s and 30s in a given year, and most people don't budget for that.
And what falls under that? Medical expenses, car problems?
Exactly. Your car breaks down, your home needs repair, you need to go visit a sick relative. And mind you, by the way, the average woman in her 20s and 30s has less than $500 saved. So budgeting for that $2,000 average unexpected expenses can be a huge relief of stress in your life if you don't have it today. Once you do that, the next thing you need to do is look at your employer's retirement plan and see if they offer a match. If they do, that's free money. You don't want to pass it up. So you invest your money up until the maximum you can for the match. Then you go back to your emergency fund. Your ideal there is to have 3 to 6 months of living expenses saved up. So you continue to build up your emergency fund. After that, Victoria, you address your debt. So what you need to do, and we have some rough rules of thumb, is if your debt is $5,000 or less, obviously you want to, stepping back, pay your debt off as fast as possible. Add another $50 a month to your debt payments if it's $5,000 or less. If it's between $5,000 and $10,000, add another $100 a month. And if it's over $10,000, add $150 a month. And that, you'd be shocked at how fast that can help bring down your debt level. And then once you do that, you get to saving.
Great. A lot of folks don't run into their credit scores until they're trying to rent or mm-hmm. buy a house. Mm-hmm. And there are services that, for a fee, will track your credit score. Is that mm-hmm. worth doing?
You know, honestly, we think it's better to do it yourselves. The government realizes that credit scores impact a wide variety of things. Just a little bit of background for those of you who may not be familiar with credit scores. As Sharon mentioned, it's a 3-digit number. Higher is better. It's basically your financial reputation. It lets lenders know how responsible you are. But it's not just lenders that use credit scores these days. Employers look at your credit score to decide if you're the kind of person that they might want to hire. Insurance companies will look at it to decide what kind of rates they're going to set for your car insurance, and sometimes even your renter's or homeowner's insurance. So it's a very important number. And now I've completely forgot the question.
Well, here, Manisha, I'll pick it up. So what Manisha's saying is your credit score is derived from something called your credit report. And there are services that will ask you for money to get your credit report. You actually have three. There's three main credit bureaus. You can get that report now free, as Manisha was saying, courtesy of the U.S. government at annualcreditreport.com. You can get that free once a year. Side note, there's a lot of imposter sites that sound very similar. You don't need to pay the money for that. It's important to check your credit reports to make sure they're accurate because they feed into this credit score that Manisha was talking about that's so important. Now, Victoria, if you don't know your credit score today, I would say it's worth at least checking one of your scores because if it's not good, you will want to improve it because it gives you access to so many things financially speaking. You can go to myfico.com and for about $15, you can pull down one credit score.
Yeah, it gets you lower rates on loans. But I mean, ultimately, that's the big plus.
The other thing that it does in terms of checking your credit score, the government allows you to check your credit report, not your credit score, for free from each of the three credit bureaus. And if you stagger it so that you check one credit report every 4 months, basically what you're doing is self-monitoring your financial reputation, and it's a great way to make sure that you haven't suffered an incidence of identity theft as well. So it's not just interest rates, but also protecting yourself.
Related to credit scores are credit cards, and every store you walk into these days will offer you one, and I have been guilty of getting a new credit card for a 10% discount on a $200 purchase. So I imagine several of you share that. It's tempting, and it's confusing if you do it too much. And you guys are very adamant in the book about just have one basic credit card. Stay out of trouble. Why is that? Why is that important?
Well, our feeling with credit cards is it's kind of like chocolate. It's good, but too much of a good thing can be bad. And one of the problems with using store credit cards is that they often charge incredibly high interest rates. And if you miss a payment on your credit card, they can raise the rate. And it doesn't necessarily even have to be on that store card that you missed the payment. On any of your credit cards, it could end up causing your store card to rise. On top of it, if you go to take out loans and you have too many credit cards, lenders can get nervous. They don't like to see that you have the ability to rack up all of this debt. And then finally, we find that if you have too much financial clutter in your life, if you have too many cards, honestly, it's tough to keep track of how much you spend, what you owe to whom. So we think when it comes to credit cards, simplicity is best. Over the long run, it's better to pass up that extra 10% and pass on that card and just keep your credit cards, we think, to two, a primary and one backup as an emergency. And if you have travel expenses or things that are reimbursed by your employer, in that case only, it's all right, we think, to have a third card so you can keep your expenses separate.
So it sounds like you should invest in a paper shredder for all those offers you get in the mail.
Absolutely.
Big time, because you also don't want your identity stolen.
Right. Let's turn topics a little bit and talk about investing. And most folks, a lot of Americans now, are investing for their retirement in work, 401k plans typically. But surveys have shown that most Americans can't tell you what they're invested in. So what's your advice for someone who, you know, isn't particularly interested in the stock market, doesn't really care all that much about it, but wants to invest smart for retirement?
Victoria, that's a great question. I think investing confuses a lot of people. So you might turn on the TV and hear some talking head talking about something you have no idea about and think that you're not investing wisely. Well, here's the good news. You should just turn the TV off, because the best investing plan, and the statistics bear this out, is a keep it simple approach. So what we recommend for your long-term money, and that's 5 years or more, if you're under the age of 50, is to really think about stocks. So your options really are real estate, bonds, and stocks. And over the past 80 years, stocks have had the highest investment return. Now, the reason you need at least 5 years on your side is they're also the most volatile. What do I mean by that? Well, you better fasten your seatbelt, because in more than 1 in 4 years in stock market history, stocks have lost a lot of money. So when you go to look at your retirement plan offerings, you need to keep in mind what I said, but what you don't want to do is just spread your money across all of the offerings. That's what a lot of people do, and there's a lot of the offerings like cash and bonds that don't really offer you the kind of growth potential that when you're in your 20s and 30s would really pay off. And Manisha, do you want to talk about specifically within stocks?
Yeah, within stocks, when you look at the typical 401k plan these days offers you anywhere from 10 to 20 options. It makes your head spin. I mean, we like this stuff and it makes our head spin. And so our keep it simple advice is to do one of two things. Our favorite option for investing in stocks is low-cost index funds. It's just an index fund is simply a basket of companies. Our favorite kind of index fund is called the S&P 500. Think of it as a nutritional smoothie with bits of the 500 largest American companies thrown in there, and it goes down nice and easy. So if an S&P 500 index fund is offered by your 401k plan, that's an easy no-brainer choice in your 20s and 30s. You can put all of your contribution there. If that's not offered, another type of fund that has come up is called a target date retirement fund, and sometimes they're also called lifestyle funds. Basically, these are baskets where companies try and make it a little bit easier for you with all these choices, and they shift the mix between stocks, bonds, and cash as you age. And the way you pick a fund is by identifying the date that's closest to the age when you expect to retire. So they tend to have names like Target Retirement Fund 2055, and that would be appropriate if you think in 2055 you'll be in your 60s and thinking about retiring.
So you guys are saying, you know what, don't diversify, because a lot of the, you know, great investment advisors will tell you, you need to be in the market, you need to be in bonds, and if you're in your 20s and 30s, you guys think, ignore that advice.
Well, what we think is if you're in your 20s and 30s and you might live till age 90 and you have 50 or 60 years on your side and time is better when it comes to the stock market, you can take the risk of the stock market for the long term, and the odds are you'll end up with more money. Now, we're absolutely not saying don't be diversified. So when Manisha talked about the S&P 500 index fund, that's a small piece of each of the 500 biggest companies in the U.S., and we think that's pretty darn good diversification.
Mm-hmm. And if I, you know, am in your age bracket, then maybe there's an argument for investing in some kind of growth mutual fund because, you know, those have the potential to have higher returns, and I can roll with the punches, right?
Well, here's kind of the dirty little secret of the financial services business, which is that 80% of people who are paid professionally to pick stocks and run growth mutual funds actually do worse than the S&P 500 index fund. So there are definitely wonderful active money managers out there, people who decide what's going in and out of their baskets on a daily basis. But unless you're really into this stuff and you really want to dig into it and identify who the best players are, and let me tell you, it'll take a lot of work because there are actually more mutual funds these days than there are publicly traded companies, if you can believe it. We say, keep it simple. You'll beat 80% of people.
Yeah, and just let me tell you one more thing. So when you're sitting and you're in your index fund and you're sitting at a dinner party and you have a guy or gal next to you who talks about their stock that doubled in 2 months, just know that they probably didn't tell you about the 10 companies that went completely south, and you're probably doing much better off.
So if I am going to take your advice and invest in an index fund like the S&P 500, how do I go about doing that? And are there some index funds that I should be wary of? Are there expenses involved? I mean, a big problem with mutual funds is that you're often incurring fees that are very hard to make mm-hmm. sense of. There's not necessarily mm-hmm. a lot of transparency mm-hmm. for the average investor. How do you be wary here?
Yeah. Well, if you invest through your employer, you're not going to have a whole lot of choice. They give you different options, and if they offer an S&P 500 index fund, hopefully, if you like them enough to go work for them, they're a good ethical place, and they'll have only put index funds into your plan that have reasonable fees. If you invest on your own, our suggestion is to go to one of the three big discount brokerage houses. Charles Schwab, Vanguard, and Fidelity are all wonderful institutions. They all offer index funds at very reasonable prices. But Victoria raises an incredibly important point, which is the return you receive at the end of the day is after the fees paid. And so any index or any mutual fund that has a fee that's much more than 1.25% starts to make us nervous. And the great thing about index funds is their fees tend to be less than 0.25%. And so they're just a wonderful low-cost vehicle.
And it sounds like someone in their 20s and 30s, not necessarily financially savvy, shouldn't be owning individual stocks, even though, you know, investors like Warren Buffett will say, invest in what you know. So if I work at The Gap here in San Francisco, should I say, well, I kind of know retail. Maybe I'll look at some retail stocks.
We'd say unless you're picking stocks for a living, you really shouldn't be picking individual stocks. If you do, think of it as gambling money. So, you know, if you are dying to find the next Google, 5% of, or less of your money. And side note, Victoria, I'm glad you raised the Gap example, because when you're working for a company, you're heavily invested in your job with that company. So the last thing you want to do is have your retirement money in that specific company. Enron is the extreme example. They had people, multimillionaires, who ended up broke overnight.
How do I make sense of, there are a lot of different options in the 401k category, and they have lots of gobbledygook tax terms attached to them. Can you make sense of those for us?
Yeah, I mean, again, what the key words to look for when you're going down through your 401k offerings are literally the phrase index fund. If you see that, pull it out, that highlight it. That's a good option. And then these phrases, target retirement fund or lifestyle fund. Those are good buzzwords to look for. The other options, you know, you'll see small cap options and international options, and they're not bad options. The point is to make a good, safe mix using those other options takes an awful lot of work. And if you're interested in doing that, there are all kinds of other books you can read. But our underlying assumption is, you know, 9/10 of us just want to do a good enough job with our money that we can get focused on the stuff in life that really matters to us. And if that's the camp that you're in, we say, again, why go there? You really will do better than 80%, and in some periods, better than 90% of people by sticking with index funds or target retirement funds or lifestyle funds.
Practically speaking, how do you recommend that someone track all of their finances? Because this all sounds wonderful in theory, and I know I should be doing it, but how on earth do I do it day to day, assuming that I don't want to keep a daily diary of my finances like Manisha? Because I think most of us would fall under that category.
Victoria, so when you say track, do you mean that you're meeting your savings goals?
Savings, just everything. I mean, should I put everything in one big Excel spreadsheet or write everything down? I mean, the entire pie.
Yeah. So, I mean, so we're fundamental believers that people are unique and they want to do things the way they want to do them. So, first of all, if you are already saving 15% for your retirement, then you're okay. You really don't need to unless you want to track the rest of your money. But if you're like most people, you probably will need to track that. And in that case, what we recommend is a 2-month reality check. It's kind of like counting calories for a diet. So take out a piece of paper. Every time you spend money, you write down how much you spend, and then you'll tally it up at the end of each month, and you'll be amazed at what you see in terms of tracking your money. You might see that you're spending so much money on takeout food when you can bring lunch from home, or that your fancy gym membership, you never go use it.
I'm not sure I want to see what, what I'm spending on, but I do get your point.
And in terms of tracking your investments, honestly, the best thing to do is track them once or twice a year. You want to invest for the long term. And I can't tell you, working in the financial services industry, how many people we meet who track things daily, hourly, even more frequently. And honestly, there's just no need. If you've set a good plan for yourself, check in every 6 months to 12 months. But looking at edit any more frequently, that can actually give you nausea. So again, why go there?
A lot of the book focuses on, you know, what to do you yourself. Mm-hmm. But you guys also go into what to do when someone else joins your financial life. And disagreements over money are often cited as the number one cause of divorce. So what's your advice? How does someone avoid that pitfall?
So we've talked about that you need to save, invest, and as Victoria points out, the third piece is to protect yourself. So before you even commit to a serious relationship, you need to reveal yourself to your partner, financially speaking. And if you're willing, there's not a polite way to say this. I mean, if you're willing to take your clothes off, in one way, you should be willing to get financially naked with your partner. And that can save you a lot of stress and fear down the road. And what we mean by that is you should sit down and exchange a list of what you own and what you owe and your credit score. Not only that, once you're in the relationship, you should be clear about who handles what financial chores. And even if everything is delegated kind of stereotypically to the man, not that we advocate that, but even if it is, you need to keep each other informed. So whomever's in charge of investing, if some investment goes substantially down, the other partner really needs to know about that. And you also need to commit to an annual checkup where you check in and really make sure you're meeting your financial goals.
At what point in a relationship would you advise doing that? The second date, maybe?
Serious relationship. Once you're moving in, you know, obviously getting married, once you're in a serious relationship. Okay. Before you sign anything that commits you to another person.
Okay.
It's important.
I thought what might be helpful is to throw out a few hypothetical scenarios, and you guys can address the questions however you see fit. Let's say I'm 25 years old, my job pays me $50,000 a year, and I plan to job hop a lot in the next decade. I'm not really sure what I want to do with my life. I have $20,000 in student loans that I haven't yet paid off. How can I save?
So first of all, 25 making $50,000, good for you. That's great. $20,000 of student loans, that's good debt. You used it for your education. And I walked through a few minutes ago the steps that you need to take in terms of paying your bills, starting your emergency fund, the employer match, filling up your emergency fund for 3 to 6 months, then having an accelerated pay down of your debt. So if you have $20,000 of student debt, you want to put another $150 beyond the required payment per month towards that debt. And then after that, you commit to your savings plan.
Manisha, would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's we can't emphasize enough that whether or not to save doesn't have to be a function of how much money you earn. It really is a mindset. I'm utterly blown away by the number of people that I've met personally in a professional context who make serious six-digit salaries and sometimes seven-digit salaries who literally are spending more than they make. So the issue isn't how much you make, it's how much you spend. And you can be in a great position or a lousy position at any salary level. So it's very easy to try and wiggle out of savings because of what you feel is a salary that's below where you'd like it to be. But you're stronger than that, so don't go there.
Okay. Let's say I'm 35 now. I've been making a six-figure income for more than 5 years, and I have a nice nest egg of $200,000. I currently rent my apartment in San Francisco. Should I buy a house or a stock fund?
So that's somewhat of a tough question to answer here in San Francisco, where housing has been such a phenomenal investment. In our book, we give a couple of rough rules of thumb about housing, which for years and years people would have considered the gospel, and today people think we're all fuddy-duddies for saying it, but we believe it. And the rules of thumb are as follows. First of all, we think that you shouldn't buy a house or even think about buying a house until you're sure you're going to be in the same place for at least 5 years. And the reason for that is there are costs associated with buying and selling a house that typically add up to about 10% of the price of a house. And by committing to be in one place for at least 5 years outside of real estate markets like San Francisco and New York, 5 years is generally the minimum amount of time period that you need to make sure you're going to recoup that. So the first rule is don't even think about housing unless you're going to be there for 5 years. The second rule of thumb, we think, is you shouldn't think about buying a house until you've saved at least 20%. Now, these days you can buy a house with nothing down, but just because you can doesn't mean that you should. And in doing that, somebody definitely is getting a good deal, but typically it's not the homeowner, it's the lender who is offering you money, and they do that because they know, for most of us, our houses are so personal, we'll scrimp and scrape everywhere that we possibly can to make sure we don't lose our homes. And so by waiting until you have 20% to put down, that's another great rule of thumb. So in this scenario, the person would have to decide how long they're going to be there, what kind of house they wanted to buy, and whether or not that nest egg would allow for that. At that point, if they can meet those two rules of thumb, then buying a home is a great investment. For many people, it's a wonderful form of forced savings. But those two rules of thumb, which again are not popular these days, we think are very important to introduce back into the financial literacy lexicon.
And I'd add a third one, which is on mortgages, and we see in the news today all too much about people losing their home because they got exotic mortgages, like an interest-only mortgage. Well, if you get an interest-only mortgage and your house price goes down and you have to sell it, you have to come up with that money. Or if interest rates go up, your mortgage payment is going to go up substantially. So when you do buy a home, really think about a fixed rate mortgage. A classic mortgage is a 30-year fixed rate mortgage.
Mm-hmm. And can I look at my house as savings? Its value could decline.
You know, it's such a there's a lot of debate about this. Certainly in markets like San Francisco and New York, where housing is so tight and gains historically have been so robust, there probably is a reasonable argument to be made that your home is a good pile of savings. The reason I'm hemming and hawing here is that when you subtract out, a house is, it's like having a pet. There are all kinds of other costs that come along with it that you might not think about when you get the cute kitty or the fluffy, warm doggy. And a house has insurance and maintenance and upkeep and property taxes. And when you take all of that out, the average house across the country, so not necessarily in San Fran, but across the country, gives the average homeowner a return that's just barely above the rate of inflation. So when it comes down to true investment gains, study after study shows stocks are where the biggest bang for the buck is.
And not only that, Victoria, so say you think of your house as saving. We got this question last night. We were with a great group of women talking, and she said that. She said, look, this pie doesn't work for me. I need to have that 15% for savings in my home. I said to her, great, what are you going to do when you're age 65? Are you going to stay in that home? And she said to me, I'm moving to Wisconsin. I said, in that case, fine, because Wisconsin's cheaper. And she said, I was kidding. And I said, well, then you need to come up with plan B.
So eat your vegetables is the message.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
Let's say I'm 45 years old. I have no savings at this point, and I make $70,000 a year, and I feel like I'm living paycheck to paycheck.
So in that case, if you are 45 years old in that situation, I would first of all say don't despair. So you're making an above average salary, and that's good. But to use Victoria's words, it's definitely time to eat your vegetables at that point. And what the reality will mean is that that person will have to save more than 10% for their retirement, quite a bit more, and they're going to have to work past age 65.
So then the pie, the savings slice grows larger.
Yeah, I mean, the way the math works out, so the 15% savings we keep talking about, over time about 5% goes to your emergency fund and things like a down payment for your house, 10% to retirement. And if you do that when you're in your 20s and 30s, you're in great shape at retirement. If you do that when you're in your 40s, meaning you start saving 10% only when you're in your 40s, you'll end up with about half of the kind of lifestyle you're living today at retirement. So it's substantially higher that you'll have to save.
And the other thing to remember, and it's a natural human tendency when you wake up at 45 and you think, oh, gosh, I need to start saving, is to want to get aggressive and find some great investment or some great deal that's going to bail you out of this pickle that you're in. And ironically, that's the worst thing that you can do. The closer you get to retirement, the less risk that you want to take on. So these steps that Sharon highlighted may not be fun. spending less so you can save more and working a little bit longer, but that is much safer than trying to knock the ball out of the park because the math of losing money is really painful. If you invest in something and it goes up only 8%, well, you may not be dancing on the table, but let's say you invest in something and it drops 80%, which could happen if you pick a flyer of a stock and it flops. Do you know how much that investment would have to go up in order for you to just break even if it drops 80%? It's 400%. And if you could find something that went up 400%, you probably wouldn't have bought the thing that went down 80% to begin with. So not trying to get too aggressive as you get closer to retirement. It goes against human intuition, but it's another very important safety step that you can factor into your thinking.
Okay, a final scenario for you guys. I'm 55, and I have some savings in my 401k, but not enough to retire on. What can I do that isn't too risky but will yield the kind of retirement lifestyle that I envision for myself?
So here again, it's what Manisha said. There may be a temptation to swing for the fences because you have a shortfall. Try to find the next Google or Microsoft. But that's exactly what you shouldn't do. It's really about, at that age, having a mix of stocks and bonds, tightening your belt, saving more, and working a little bit longer. But what I would say, Victoria, is anyone who is tending to their finances and listening to this, and I do see a lot of our peers in the audience. I'm 32, Manisha's 36, and we see a lot of people here who are around our age. And if you're tending to your finances now, you're just going to be in terrific shape. So really good for you.
What are the big mistakes that young people tend to make?
Probably the biggest mistake is spending too much on your home. And this may not be quite as true in San Francisco, but in other cities, too much on your car. There's a lot of talk about the small things in life and frittering away on too many shoes or purses or lattes or whatever. But when most people look at their pie and they're in financial agony, the biggest source of the agony was biting off more than they could chew in one of those two big departments. And our rough rules of thumb are, again, pretty conservative, but they'll enable you to move forward comfortably. And it's to say that your combined total expenses on your home and your transportation should be no more than 35% of your gross income. In San Francisco, where you may not have a car, chances are your housing will be the biggest portion of that and your transportation will be much smaller. I live in Houston, so a car is very necessary. You don't have public transportation, but housing is less expensive. Car is a bigger piece of that slice. Housing may be smaller. But 35%, if you're spending much more than that on housing and transportation, there's just not going to be a lot left for everything else.
And also, two others, credit card debt. Mm-hmm. So the average credit card debt in our country is $9,000. Too many young people do treat their credit cards as free money, and that interest rates on those credit cards can be astronomical. So if you have it, don't despair, but please, please start working it down. And then the other is health insurance, just a mind-boggling and frankly, you know, just way too high number of young people in particular go without health insurance. And, you know, we think we're invincible at this age, but if something serious happens, it can cause a major issue, not just for your finances, but for your family's finances.
And if you are in that bucket, ehealthinsurance.com, all one word, ehealthinsurance.com is a great place where you can look for catastrophic policies, which aren't great. They're not going to cover prescription drugs and routine doctor visits, but they will give you a modicum of a safety net underneath you.
I have one more question, and then we're going to go to audience questions. And there's a mic right there, so please get your questions ready. Last question is, what are the little mistakes that people make? You know, for example, in credit card debt, in taking out a loan, what are the little pitfalls, you know, the ways that companies pull a gotcha on you if you're not paying attention?
The credit card tricks.
Well, you know, a classic one is, well, I got a good credit card interest rate, either a 0 or, you know, even a 7%, and then you're out busy partying and you forget to pay that bill on time, and even if it's a day late, it's probably going to jack up well over 20%, which is just a huge interest rate. So that's a real common one.
Another one is you think you're applying, it's the old bait and switch, so you get a credit card application in the mail for, you know, a zero balance card or something that sounds really attractive, and so you sign up for it, but you don't read the small print, and in the small print, it says for qualified applicants only, and the card you get in the mail is a very different one, but you don't realize it. That's a very common trap. Another one would be using those so-called free checks, the convenience checks that come in the mail, or using your credit card to get a cash advance. Those are some of the most expensive ways to access money because the interest rate tends to be higher. There typically are fees attached to them, and the interest starts accruing from the moment you use that money. There's no grace period, as there typically is with a traditional charge purchase.
Before we go to questions, I'd like to say you're listening to the Commonwealth Club's In Forum program, and tonight we're talking about personal finance for the modern woman. I'm Victoria Barrett, associate editor of Forbes magazine, and I'm here with Manisha Thakur and Sharon Kadar. The first question, go ahead.
Hi, Manisha. Hi, Sharon. I have two questions for you. The first one is, when I was in college, I wasn't very financially savvy. So what I did was I opened a lot of credit cards so that, you know, just for free South Park t-shirts. Mm-hmm. I don't use those credit cards. I only have one that I actually use. But I'm afraid that if I do close all those credit cards, then my credit rating score will drop significantly. Currently, I have a really good credit rating score. So what should I do?
Are you getting ready to buy a home or a car in the next 6 months?
No.
Then go ahead and close them down now. The only time that credit score is really going to impact you from that standpoint is if you're about to make a major purchase. Much better for you to get rid of that financial clutter today.
Okay, gotcha. Another question I've got is, in addition to 401k, what I have is I have a lot of savings in this online bank that gives about 5% interest rate, which is pretty good, pretty decent for savings. So are you advocating that I would take that amount of money out and put it into an index fund?
So the question is, when will you need to use that money? Are you going to plan to use it over the next 5 years or beyond 5 years?
Oh, good question. Probably beyond five.
Okay, yeah. Because that's an excellent question. First of all, if you are going to use it, I know you're not, but for the rest of the audience, if you're going to use your money over the next 5 years, the way that you have your money invested is a great way to earn interest, because over the next 5 years, your goal is really to protect your money from inflation, and 5% from an online bank can be great. Since you're not going to use it for five or more years, what you're probably better off doing is going to a discount brokerage firm like the ones that Manisha mentioned and opening an account and considering the index funds that we talked about.
Okay. So are there a lot of initial investment to opening that account? Like, i.e., is there a lot of, like, if you go to a broker, do you have to pay for that service? Or is that, you know, a lot of transaction funds that you have to...
It's a wonderful question. Part of the reason we like to cite these three firms, Vanguard, Fidelity, and Charles Schwab, is that they don't have those extraneous fees. There are two different types of places that you can go to invest, broadly speaking. One is a discount brokerage house, such as the ones I just mentioned. The other is a full-service brokerage house. Full-service brokerage houses can be wonderful, but they're really more applicable when you have a much larger asset base, because the fees they charge you are bigger, because they're not only engaging in transactions for you, but they're also ostensibly providing you a lot of detailed and valuable advice. When you're just starting out, you don't need to pay those high fees. It's much simpler. Each firm has its own minimums. But typically, if you call their 800 number or visit them on the web and you agree to do routine direct deposits each month, oftentimes you can open accounts with as little as, you know, in some cases it's $100, some cases it's $1,000. But if you'll commit to investing each month, sometimes they'll even waive those minimums.
That's good. Good news. Well, since there's no other question, I'm going to ask one last one. Okay, one last one. So I have Roth IRA right now. I've been contributing to this ever since I graduated from college. My question is, should I use part of my savings mm-hmm. into an IRA fund versus putting into savings or into index funds?
Great question. So your retirement money, you really have two places where you can put that money. One is if you do work for an employer that offers a retirement plan, that's one place. The other is an IRA, as you talked about. Both are tax advantaged and basically mean that you pay Uncle Sam less money over time. And I would say you should put your money in either of those options for your retirement.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. Thanks.
Any other questions in the audience?
I currently invest through my company 401k, but they don't match.
Could you speak in a little bit? I'm not sure we can all hear you. Thanks.
I currently invest in my company's 401k. They don't match at all. Mm-hmm. Do you suggest I continue to invest through my 401k or put money in a Roth IRA?
In that example, if you don't mind doing a little bit of a financial cha-cha-cha, we recommend the order of priority is company 401k up to the point of match, then fully fund the Roth IRA, and then return back to the 401k. So in your case, since there is no match, you'd fully fund the Roth, and then if you can afford to save anything else after that, then you'd return to your employer plan. And one of the side benefits, the benefit of doing it through your employer is it's easy. It comes out of your paycheck. The benefit of doing it in the Roth is that you get to pick where you want to open that account, and you can make sure you're opening it at an organization that offers nice, low-cost index funds.
That probably makes it easier to take with you if you change jobs too, right?
Absolutely.
Go ahead. Next question.
I know I'm a bit young to be asking this, but it's in the news, and I was just curious to see what you guys thought of it. There's a book that you've probably heard of called The Feminine Mistake.
Right.
That came out a couple of weeks ago, and basically it's a woman who's saying, mm-hmm. is warning women about taking time off to raise their children mm-hmm. because it might really hurt their financial futures mm-hmm. after retirement. Do you have any, should we be really thinking about saving up for the possibility of taking a few years off? Or what's your opinion on that?
Yeah, so we think that the author is a bit misunderstood. We think what she's trying to say is when you decide to be a stay-at-home mom, you need to consider the financial consequences, and you need to know fully what you're getting into. And she's not necessarily advocating not being a stay-at-home mom. Now, if you do take that route, you know, one of the things you should definitely do is, we just talked about IRAs, you can have what's called a spousal IRA. So the government allows, even if you're not earning income, if your partner is and you're married, you to have a spousal IRA, which will give you retirement security of your own. Manisha, would you add to that?
I mean, it's interesting. The feminine mistake is, for those of you who may not have heard about it, it's a book. The title is a play on Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique, and it's raised this maelstrom of criticism. Interestingly enough, a lot of that comes from people who admit that they haven't actually even read the book. And what's fascinating is...
You have strong opinions if you haven't read a book.
Oh, well, but I got very into this book because I love The Feminine Mystique. It was a very meaningful book to me, and so I wanted to read The Feminine Mistake. And on Amazon and on the Wall Street Journal, there are a number of blogs, and it's very polarized by age. Women in their 20s and 30s express extreme anger, and I think it's understandable because it feels like everything's on our shoulders. We're supposed to, you know, work hard and bear the children and clean the house and do everything, and now somebody's telling us that we can't even take a break. Whereas the positive comments were coming from women in their 50s and 60s who were saying, have so been there, have so done that, please do not make the same mistake that we made. And the answer that we're trying to say is it doesn't have to be either or, that there are some financial steps that you can take to protect yourself while you are staying at home. And so, for instance, if you choose to stay at home with your children and you fully fund a spousal IRA, that's almost as if you were working and earning a salary of $50,000 a year and 15% of it were being set aside for you. So there are steps that you can take so that you can have the economic freedom. But I think the overarching point that we would say we do agree with is it's important to have this dialogue about money. Her main point is money is this pink elephant in the room, and we do need to talk about it.
Next questions.
Thanks. I have two questions. First of all, I'm just wondering
if you could maybe make a little bit more of the distinction of the IRA, like I'm self-employed, so I have a SEP IRA. Mm-hmm. I know other people, probably more common is other types that I'm not aware of, and how that fits in with the index funds. And the second question I have is maybe if you could just speak a little bit to prioritizing paying off loans. Student loans went way down for a while. I have like a 2.5% loan interest on like $30,000 or something for a student loan. So for me, I'm thinking that that's like almost inflation. I'm going to put that off as long as possible compared to like 6% loans that I also have. And so maybe just speak a little bit about prioritizing and how to think about that.
Yeah, great question. So I'll take the first and I'll let Manisha take the second. So a lot of folks think when you open up an account like an IRA account that that's it, that you're done. But there's actually two steps which you raise. So it's kind of like when you go to dinner, that's the first part, but then you have to order off the menu. And that's where index funds come in. So when you open up an IRA, that's like going to the dinner place, but then you have to order off the menu. Where is your money going to go? And how are you going to invest it? And that's what you do when you pick an index fund. It sits in your IRA.
I think part of her question is also just the difference between the various IRA options.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's enough to make even an accountant's head spin. I mean, there's so many different types of IRAs. There's simple IRAs and SEP IRAs and Roth IRAs and rollover IRAs.
The simple one sounds good.
And what's interesting is the simple one is the most complex of them. But basically, if you are self-employed, what the government tries to do with a SEP IRA is blend together features of both a 401k and an IRA. In a Roth or a traditional IRA, the income limits are or the contribution limits are fairly modest relative to what you can put into a SEP IRA. So in your head, if you're self-employed, think, great, instead of having to worry about the financial cha-cha-cha between the 401k and the Roth IRA, I only have to worry about one account, the SEP IRA. And now that I've picked the account, as Sharon said, let me order off the menu and put index funds into it.
And then the other question on debt, I think that's a great question, and it's one of the nuanced issues that we didn't address in the book, but it's an excellent one that we talked about a lot. And it's, you know, if your interest rate on your debt is 6-7%, then really there isn't a need to be in a huge rush to have accelerated payments on that debt. Most debt these days is a lot higher than that. But in your case, if it's 2.5%, I wouldn't be in any rush to pay it off.
Next question, go ahead.
I was looking into, am I talking? Okay. I was looking into purchasing a house and thinking about only doing 5% down. Mm-hmm. I've done a little bit of research, and in San Francisco, our cost of living increases by 3.2%. So our apple today that we buy for $1, next year it's $1.03. Mm-hmm. And we haven't actually had any decreases we've always had appreciation in property except for after our earthquake. So I'm wondering, because you were saying, you know, don't purchase a house unless you're, you know, have 20% down and you're planning on living here for 5+ years and you also are considering, you know, your closing costs. And I've looked into it. Closing costs don't actually add up to 20% of the purchase price for the purchase and as well as selling combined, because it's roughly, you know, $9,000 to maybe $15,000 and for the purchase, and then you have to double it when you sell it as well.
Yeah, I mean, in San Francisco, New York, and Boston, housing really is a very different issue, maybe D.C. as well, I'd throw in that bucket, than the rest of the country. First of all, just to be clear, and I wasn't earlier, when I said the cost of buying and selling a home combined tend to be around 10%. Generally, closing costs on the purchase of a home will be about 3% of the price. Mm-hmm. And then typically on the back end, when you sell, you'll pay a realtor 6%. Plus, you'll probably have to spend a little bit of money to freshen up the home before you go and sell it. So it's the buying and selling combined that is 10%, not 20%. On 5% down, here's the problem with putting 5% down. About the only thing you can expect in life is the unexpected. So if you put 5% down and it just happens to be in one of those periods where, God forbid, there is an earthquake or, God forbid, there is a softening in the market and you have to sell, you have very little cushion. And so you could end up having to pay back the company from which you borrowed money to buy your home more than you actually receive in the sale. Now, that's a risk. Any investment is a risk. If you feel the odds of that are very low, then it's okay. So these are rules of thumb, not absolute written laws. But one of the things that we're trying to highlight is we feel that mortgage companies and financial companies in general haven't given consumers enough information about the potential risks that they face when they do buy a home for less than 20% down. You face less risk in a market like San Francisco or New York than you do in the rest of the country. But there was a reason why that 20% rule of thumb was in place for so long, and it's really to protect ourselves.
Okay, and then, sorry, one other quick question. The lender that I was speaking with was saying that I should have 2 to 4 trade lines open instead of just 2, as you were saying before, one primary and then being one your secondary. Meaning that it makes me a stronger borrower, as well as keeping the trade line that I've had the longest open. Definitely don't close that, because
you guys do say that in the book.
Right. Well, what they say is when they talk about trade lines, they don't mean have 4 credit cards. What the ideal kind of borrower would have, and this is sort of odd, but they would have 4 different. You would have 3 or 4 different types of debt. So you would have maybe before you buy a home, and again, this is for the whole country, but you'd have a car loan. So that's one type of loan. You might have a student loan, and then you might have 2 credit cards, and that would create the 4 types. Really what a lender is trying to make sure is that you are sufficiently credit worthy that they're not going to end up owning your house. You're going to end up owning your house. And if your financial situation is such that simply on the basis of your income stream and having 2 credit cards, you are unable to get a mortgage, in this day and age when people are so willing to lend you money, that's also another sign that maybe the house you're looking at is a little bit out of your reach at this stage. If your income is sufficiently high enough to cover the monthly payments, people are going to be more than happy if you have just 2 credit cards and no other kind of debt to loan you money.
One question I'd like to ask before we go to you is a lot of folks say, well, renting is just throwing money down the drain. Bye.
Well, Victoria, that's a great question, because you have to think about the trade-off. And for instance, the scenario that you brought up, you know, hypothetically, you buy a house for $300,000, an apartment, and you all of a sudden need to move. Note hypothetically, but okay, so... So then you have to move in 2 years to Phoenix, right? And the market is not always going straight up. And the market has softened a bit, and it's down $50,000. Your house is down $50,000. So then, you know, you're able to sell it for $250,000. Not only do you have to pay fees, but you have to come up with a shortfall between your 5% down and the money you lost on the house. So if you don't buy a house in a smart manner, you can lose a lot more money than if you rent.
Go ahead, next question.
I'm a public school teacher, and so we don't pay into So we have a 403B. Is there any other anything different that I should be thinking of, or anything, any other issues?
No, a 403B, and actually that's a great point. If you work for corporations, it's called 401Ks, and we just kind of we use it generically like Kleenex or Xerox. But if you work for school, it's the same thing, but it's in the educational system, it's called a 403B. If you work in the government, it'll be called a thrift savings plan. There are also certain agencies where it's called a 457 plan. These really creative names are all parts of the tax code, and they all work the same.
Are there any websites that you guys recommend for people to make sense of all these arcane words and acronyms?
Well, at risk of sounding like an advertisement for our book, part of the reason why we wrote On My Own 2 Feet was because, honestly, there really aren't. There's a wonderful website called bankrate.com, and it has good technical articles, especially if you're looking to buy a house. It has a wonderful section just on housing, bankrate.com. We're also big fans of cnnmoney.com. They have good general personal finance articles. But the truth of the matter is it's hard to get this information. I mean, we're Harvard MBAs. Between the two of us, we have 18 years of work experience in financial services. It took us 3 years to write this book because we had to ferret out. There's so much noise to really find simple answers to basic questions. It's not so simple.
It doesn't sound simple at all. But thank you for clarifying some of the major points. And are there any other questions? Go ahead.
We discussed credit cards a lot. I get credit card applications every day. Is there any specific company, credit card, credit percentage that we should be paying or look for? Miles, a lot of credit cards with miles, they have an annual fee. Is it worth it?
Yeah, usually the perks aren't really worth it. It's generally worth it to just look for the lowest fee card and the card that has the lowest interest rate. For the cards that the applications that you get that you're not going to use, make sure you either rip them up or shred them, because identity thieves really like to go after those.
How would you recommend looking for that card that has the lowest interest rate?
You know, there's websites like cardweb.com and
bankrate.com.
Exactly, bankrate.com that can allow you to compare credit cards.
But again, if you're paying your card off in full at the end of each month, doesn't matter what the interest rate is, because you'll never have to pay interest because you'll be paying it off each month.
That's the idea.
So in that case, what you want is a no-fee card.
Right.
And again, Bankrate and Cardweb will list. You can search under there for no-fee cards.
Great. This will probably be our last question. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to go back to the housing question. Mm-hmm. And my scenario is similar to the second one you had presented to them, with a little less money in the bank. But so what in a market like this one, like San Francisco, mm-hmm. which is a fairly reliable housing market, but expensive. So mm-hmm. we're looking at from rent to one bedroom for $500,000. Mm-hmm. It can be a big jump in. Mm-hmm. quality of life, all kinds mm-hmm. of issues. Mm-hmm. What is the trigger point where you say, you know, this is a good investment to invest in housing versus, you know, putting your money into something like an index fund? Is it a matter also of just personal priorities, or is there some kind of trigger?
Yeah, I mean, I wish there were this magic rule of thumb that we could put out there for when you cross over the line and do it. A lot of it boils down to your risk tolerance. You might tell from our comments, we're generally more on the conservative end of the risk spectrum. I think that it's very difficult to put a price tag on mental peace of mind and happiness and family and belonging, but those are all really important things. And so we default back to a saying in the medical profession, which is first do no harm. So as long as buying that home is not going to put you in a situation where meeting your mortgage payments or your utility bills or your property tax bills are going to keep you from doing other important things that you need to do, buy medicine, pay for food, have some fun, then go ahead and do it. The one thing you want to make sure you don't do is put yourself in a situation where you end up being house poor. You've got the house, but you're just strapped and you don't have room for anything else. And that's such a subjective line, but that's the framework in which we'd advise thinking about that question in this kind of housing market.
I mean, personally, peace of mind for me is having a landlord, so maybe I'm just kind
of... You want to be your own landlord? Well, thank you very much to you both, and please give a big round of applause to Manisha and Sharon. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club's In Forum is adjourned.